If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Today we are looking at Sharpeville Massacre. As we know, today is Human Rights Day. Very, very significant day in our liberation history. And we thought there is none other than Steve Lebelo, a historian, who can help us unpack details that you may not be very familiar with. And you're also very welcome to ask questions. Maybe questions that you thought were not really questions that you can ask. Maybe you were too shy. There is no question that is too simple. There is no question that is too stupid. Ntate Lebelo, thank you so much for your time. Good evening and welcome.
Hi, good evening, Tumelo, and thanks for the invitation.
Thank you very much for making time for us. We've spoken about Sharpeville before, but there are things that I think we would like to delve a bit deeper into. Ntate Lebelo, this Sharpeville massacre, when you look at the contextualizing it in the history of our liberation history, this is a pivotal moment. This was the moment. And yes, there were protests before this particular massacre and so on. But this is the moment that, you know, arguably shaped a lot of our protest history.
Yes, yes. Pimela, when we discussed this with the producer, you know, she said we can start at the beginning. And I was thinking to myself, just maybe the beginning may well be, you know, the birth of Sobukwe.
Yes.
But let's be realistic about it, you know, and bring it much closer.
Yes.
You know, it depends at what point we began, one, to have at least a grasp, you know, of historically
mm-hmm.
what the Sharpeville movement was about.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that
yes.
we can isolate, you know, and begin to talk about.
So,
you know, the idea that it was merely a response to the imposition of the past laws
mm.
is only part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But we really need to understand, you know, what the long-term impact
yes.
and what the long-term view of the past laws would have been.
Yeah, and maybe that's exactly it. Unpacking just from a strategic point of view as a historian, the reasons behind the apartheid regime to implementing this policy of the past law upon black people and what it was meant to achieve for that particular regime.
To answer the question, you know, we have to look at what point and what legislation, you know, was actually passed as part of a kind of a mechanism, you know, to implement a particular kind of social order.
Mm.
One may even see this as a kind of a social engineering, you know, a kind of population engineering of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Because the pressures that the Nationalist Party was faced with, you know, was that it had to respond to its constituency,
mm.
the constituency that put it into power
mm.
In 1948. And it had to demonstrate that immediately after 1948, that it is committed to doing so. Now, how do the past laws fit into this? Part of what its constituency would have been worried about, and this constituency is the Afrikaner farming community. What they would have been worried about is actually the distribution of labor,
mm.
you know, between the rural areas, particularly between the commercial farms
mm.
and the urban areas, in such a way that there is always, you know, a reserve labor in the rural areas
mm.
that the farming community can draw from.
Mm.
And because that labor would be in excess of what commercial agriculture wanted, they could then, you know, drive down the wages. That would be the economical, you know, the economic mm. calculations,
mm.
you know, that went into it.
Mm.
So the past laws become part of a bigger legislation. It is the Native Laws Amendment Act of 1951. This is only 3 years after the Nationalist Party came to power.
Mm.
And Section 10 of that legislation is what we are talking about.
Yes.
Sharpeville actually happens because of the ways in which Section 10 was being implemented. Now, very briefly, what Section 10 would have done is to designate, you know, the bearers of passes as to whether they qualified to be in the urban areas or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did not qualify, you know, over time they might be able to you know, renew their qualification in the urban areas, depending on changes in circumstances, including getting a job. You know, because getting a job would have guaranteed them a stay in Sharpeville. You know, that's the qualification. Mm-hmm. But in a situation where labor turnover was so high, loss of a job was an easy thing to happen. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people would have fallen victim of that, of not qualifying to be in the urban area. Mm-hmm. One of the ways in which they dealt with it, and this is important, was to, you know, simply disappear into the anonymity of everything, because there they could not be detected. But still, you know, it was living on the edge of legality, precisely because, you know, Section 10(1), you know, of the Native Laws Amendment Act was being, you know, rigorously implemented. Now, within 9 years to 10 years, and 1960 is 10 years of that act, you know, by then, the cumulative effect, you know, had been enough to mobilize the community into something to do. So when the positive action campaign was proposed, you know, by the PAC, you know, it fell on people who were already, you know, prepared to do that. And this is the way we have to stay, you know, because in the ultimate end, if you are disqualified from being in Sharpeville, you're going to have to be sent to a designated homeland. Sharpeville happened to be a South Sotho speaking area. And historically, families in Sharpeville by 1960 were actually coming from white commercial farms. Mm. They never had a Bantustan to go back to. And that in itself would have been a major predicament. Now, all these things came together, you know, to create a very volatile situation. So it was easier for people to really put their lives on the line, you know, and actually face the bullets. So it is not only the humiliation of carrying the pass. Mm-hmm. It is that the pass was part of a long-term plan. And it is that long-term plan that has been, you know, confronted.
You highlighted earlier that we could have started with the birth of Sobukwe. That's not where we started. So I want to bring him in though now, because he had been working very hard, leading up to this day, you know, mobilizing, coming into the factories and so on, getting the workers who were obviously residents in the township to plan for this day. It's a very important point here, because we'll get to the date and how we get to actually the date itself and the rivalry between the PAC and the ANC. Let's talk about that plan. What was his plan as the leader of the PAC at the time?
People, you've done your homework quite well, precisely. You know, and this is the one part that most people have actually lost sight of, maybe also have not been exposed to. You know, what we have to really reflect upon is that the PAC was actually founded in April 1959. And, you know, hardly a year later, in March 1960, the positive action campaign is undertaken, which finally leads to the massacre. Now, you are right. I mean, a lot of, you know, organization and mobilization went into, you know, into putting the things together. And one can actually point out to the fact that 3 weeks leading up to the 21st of March, Sobukwe actually undertook a number of visits to the Vaal area. But in most cases, it was actually to Everton, where he convened a number of meetings. And it is important to identify, you know, the people he actually met with. And two of the most important people who were, you know, the go-between Sobukwe and the community were actually brothers, the Wesi brothers. Mm-hmm. You know, people can look them up and actually get the details. Mm-hmm. And these two people were actually leaders of what we call shop floor formations, you know, factory formations that represented the workers. So there were several meetings between Sobukwe and worker representatives. And if you think about it, there were three, you know, major industries in the Vaal at the time that employed hundreds of people. And for the positive action campaign, you know, to be successful, it is the adult population, the adult working population that had to be mobilized. you know, which explains why the Wesley brothers would have been critical in this, you know, process of mobilization. And, you know, the three factories that were there was actually African Cables and ISCO, and across the river you would have had Sasol. And these are the three factories that actually employed hundreds of people. And those are the people that Sibuko was able to connect, you know, before the 21st of March. So a great deal of organization went into it. But the most important thing here, Pinot, and we have to understand this. Some people might be saying this is a romanticization of Sobukwe's paradigm, you know, and to some extent it may be true. But the reality here is that, you know, the whole organization, if you think about it, the past laws would be targeting individuals. I mean, you are alone, you are at a station, you are confronted by a policeman. But cumulatively, you know, it cuts across the community as a whole. What it needed was very careful organization of the campaign. And this actually happened leading up to, you know, up to the day itself. There is no way one can underestimate, you know, the amount of work that went into organizing the 21st of March. But in addition to that, you know, 5 days before the 21st, Sobukwe actually wrote a letter to the commissioner of police indicating that this is what's going to happen, that the whole thing was going to be peaceful. Mm. But, you know, and he warned that, you know, it is possible that there may be violence, but he was actually pleading with the commissioner, you know, that they should act with restraint. Mm. So that too is, you know, indication of just how much planning went into this. You know, often than not, we think of mass movements as spontaneous and maybe largely spontaneous and less organized. But here we are talking about, you know, a campaign that was well organized and well orchestrated before it actually took place.
Well, as I said, you know, a part of the issue here was that the ANC blaming the PAC for being too premature in all of this, you know, taking their thunder. So obviously, again, here watching that rivalry pan out. And it was, you know, unfortunate. It was unfortunate. 69 people dying and scores being maimed. So it's not really a day for anybody to take glory in that sense.
Pimena, just as well, you are raising this question. And the way to deal with this question, again, you know, it is to locate, you know, the Sharpeville massacre within, you know, a long range, you know, of mass mobilization. And we are here looking at the entire decade, you know, the 1950s. And we are looking at the mass movement that would have, in fact, be associated with the ANC. And then the question actually becomes, you know, if the Sharpeville moment was the culmination, you know, of the mass movement of the 1950s. Why is it now that the PAC claims it for itself, whereas the entire decade saw a mass mobilization that was associated with the ANC? And here is an answer, Pimela, a quick answer. During that 10-year period, where there was mass mobilization, it was Africanists inside the ANC, you know, who were particularly active in connecting the ANC with the masses. And this becomes quite apparent in Sharpeville, you know, because when they break away in 1958, you know, to form the PAC, there is no difficulty in mobilizing the masses, precisely because the same people, you know, who were the face of the ANC for the rest of the decades, to the masses, were now in the PAC and mobilizing the masses. That's one of, you know, that's part of it. But the other part of it is that the main...
We can still hear you, Dr. Lubin. Can you hear me? All right, let me take a quick break. I'll sort that line out, and then I'll be back with you in a short while.
Point of View.
Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.
All right, let's hope everything is fine now. Tadelibelo, can we continue our conversation?
Hello?
Hello, is everything okay in Tadelibelo?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Okay, so let's...
But was it clear? I'm actually worried. did everything come through?
I mean, everything came through. Actually, we didn't lose anything at all. Let's then talk about the day. Obviously, unfortunately, happened and turned out to be quite a massacre. It really wasn't just a beating; it was a massacre, as if you know these were not human beings being mowed down. So we need to really recognize how the police, the brutality of the people of the police here, showed its face. And obviously leaving a people very scarred, Ntatelebelo. I mean, fear, absolute fear amongst the people in Sharpeville. But also anger, rage, anger, frustration at what had happened.
Pimelo, in history we often talk about the period, you know, between Sharpeville and Soweto. And normally we characterize the period as one of political quiescence or one of political lull. But at the center of the explanation is the brutality of the apartheid state, especially in relation to Sharpeville. What is understood is that, you know, as a consequence of the massacre in Sharpeville, any kind of major, you know, kind of upheaval or significant challenge to the apartheid state, you know, was actually, you know, put on ice, if one may say that. But here is something that, you know, we really need to recognize, that despite the fact that you had that 15 years, you know, of political lull and political quiescence, you still have, you know, on the other hand, on the other side of the divide, you have the white supremacist imaginary during that period. It is important to characterize it in those terms. What that actually means is that in the white imaginary, you know, what they actually understand as the Swart Gevaar was understood to be always lurking beneath the surface. And the question was, at what point was it going to explode? So this is one of, you know, those consequences of the massacre itself and what its short-term and long-term consequences would have been. What that actually means is that, you know, the community in Sharpeville has a deeply embedded tradition of resistance to white supremacy. Mm. And you need a kind of constellation of forces at any one time, you know, for that to explode into the open. And I know we don't seem to think quite, you know, seriously about it. But if you take away, you know, the 1976-77 moment, the next time South Africa was plunged into, you know, a kind of mass movement that impacted the whole country, it once again erupted in Sharpeville, you know, on the 4th of September, 1984. So the point here I'm making is that certain, you know, attributes, you know, that are so often associated with a particular kind of radicalism may be spread across the country. But in reality, there are certain places that become the epicenters and the repositories, you know, of such tendencies. And Sharpeville would stand out as one.
As you speak of that, then, let's bring in Boko, the military wing of the PAC.
Yes.
Which at this point became quite active, really doing a lot of the work, yes, underground, but quite effective in some of the we'll call them some of their missions, right?
Yes.
It's interesting that very little is spoken of this group, men and women who are fighting quite angrily at the regime.
Yes.
And it's subsequent to some of the cases, that there were cases that obviously went to trial, but there was a parallel happening here, and we don't equate the significance of these parallels. The Revolta trial, as well as some of the military wing men and women who were going on trial, military wing men and women going on trial, because you hear more of the Rivonia trialist trial than the other trial, and yet both were fighting, you know, the same regime and maybe at the same intensity, if not more.
You know, I've just tonight, you know, I was in a session, and what you've just said is precisely what I was pointing out at. But we have to really, you know, also give it a kind of. You are right. You are definitely right. I mean, you had, terror tribes, you know, that involved poor cooperatives. And they actually took place in a number of jurisdictions. And Grahamstown in particular, you know, would have hosted quite a number of those tribes, precisely because a lot of the political activity would have happened in the Eastern Cape across the Transkei. You know, that's the one part. But also, there were political activities, particularly in Kagiso and Mohlakeng in Randfontein. And that also led to one or two trials that were, you know, that were held in Pretoria. But in Cape Town also, I mean, there were quite a number of trials of political operatives. And you are right. You know, those trials can actually be characterized as kangaroo courts, you know, because they were so swiftly done and the verdicts were so swiftly passed. Mm. And wherever there was a verdict of guilty, they were convicted and sentenced to death. Mm. Now, these are not exaggerated figures. Mm. Mm. Between 1962 and 1969, you know, 135 black people were executed, you know, across the country. Of that 135, 95 of them were political operatives, and this is not an exaggeration. Now, if you compare the fact that there was no media coverage, no international press that was interested in the political trials, there has to be an explanation for that. And the explanation has to do with political, you know, commitment to violence. Mm. Now, if you think about the political insurrection of 1961 to 1963, you know, some of the, you know, attacks were attacks on people merely because they were white. Mm. The Bashir River attack, this was an attack on a white family, you know, of five people. Mm. And they were attacked with machetes and they were killed. Mm. And the operatives were caught up with and they were put on trial, found guilty, and sentenced to death. Mm. I'm giving this as just one example. Mm. But we, in the broader sense, Pinelo, when we talk about anti-colonial struggles, particularly in South Africa, one of the things that we wrestle with is the violence that is generated by the oppressed. Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes a very difficult thing to actually justify. Mm. And for that reason, you know, POCO's activities, you know, find them, you know, this is why. I mean, it is, even if you think about Sobukwe himself, in an interview with Gail Gerhard, and one might say Sobukwe was, you know, being a bit dishonest, but he certainly put a distance between himself and Boko.
I was going to ask you about that, about his sentiments about that, and whether those sentiments, were they because it was much later on that he reflects on that? Do we know how he felt about those operations at the time?
Yes, and if you look at Tamika Plagi's biography, mm-hmm. although he doesn't actually wrestle with this issue of linking Sobukwe to Poko. Mm-hmm. Part of what he does, you know, is to depict Sobukwe as a very, you know, religious mm-hmm. Christian kind of person. Mm-hmm. And expectations are that it is that side of Sobukwe that might, mm-hmm. you know, tilt over the scales. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he, at the very least, you know, he would be somewhat, you know, critical of Poko, and at worst, you know, he would be totally, you know, disgusted by it. But the impression that we get from Gail Gerhard is that he was disapproving of it. Mm-hmm. But here's a question here, mm-hmm. Pimelo. Gail Gerhard did not take any tape into the interview. She interviewed Sobukwe without taking down any, you know, any kind of record. She recreated the interview, you know, after it had been done. Mm. And just there, you know, you begin to have some kind of doubt.
Wow. Appreciate your time. As always, really appreciate you giving us all of this insight, historian.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ntateli
Bilo.
Okay,
no,
thanks.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.